Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Let's get to the docket. First, Letitia Stauch. Well, words have meaning in the law. We're going to find out what those words mean. Second, Brian Laundry, how he died. Ahmaud Arbery, the trial, it's still ongoing. The jury deliberations continue. Alex Murdoch wants people to stop talking about him, and one person in particular. Andrew Cuomo, well, we learned some things, probably what most already knew. Smash and grabs, though, they're moving down the coast to Beverly Hills. And then finally, our dumb criminal. It is Tuesday, November 23rd. Let's get to the docket. First, Letitia Stauch. Let's call her case. Well, there's a lot of stuff going on, some recent filings in her case. First, the defense has filed a motion to seal and hold confidential jail records of visits or meetings between Letitia Stauch and the defense team and their agents. Now, I can tell you, ladies and gentlemen, don't think I've ever seen this. I don't think it's really ever been an issue. But the defense for Letitia Stauch wants to reiterate that the defendant, in this case, Letitia Stauch, has a right to effective assistance of counsel and privileged communications between Mrs. Letitia Stauch and her attorneys. And basically, in this motion, the defense says that experts and investigators ought to be able to see Ms. Stauch unencumbered in their visitations without basically being monitored in some particular way. Little bit of case law cited in the defense motion, but those were cases where literally the deputies were standing right there next to somebody and the sheriff was relaying what they heard in the conversations to the prosecution. Now, that's somewhat interesting set of circumstances, doesn't come up very often. And yes, that would more than likely be a violation of the attorney-client privilege. And so what the defense is asking for is to exclude from trial or sentencing or for any other purpose, attorney-client communications, records of any visitations by Mrs. Stauch's attorneys or their agents, and also enter into an immediate order that under no circumstances may anyone from the El Paso County Sheriff's Office or the El Paso County Detention Center reveal any information to the prosecution or its agents about visits Letitia Stauch may have had with defense counsel or its members. You think, okay, that kind of seems like a pretty rudimentary request, right? Like, why is this even an issue? It shouldn't be an issue. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, this is why it's going to get interesting here, is that at the arraignment of Letitia Stauch, it was a normal arraignment. Enter a plea of not guilty, waive further reading or advisement of the charges, set the matter for motions, set a trial date, set those motions date. They are ready to roll. However, now, at the arraignment, the defense attorney said something rather interesting, okay? The defense stated that they are going to give notice pursuant to Colorado Revised Statute 16-8-1073B. What is that? Basically said, it is likely that we are going to introduce evidence by a mental health expert regarding Mrs. Stauch's condition after the disappearance of Gannon Stauch. So what is the significance of that? Well, like I said, the law is very specific. Words matter. That's why people should take great care in what they say and what they draft when they put it into a statute, because there are certain effects that take place. So when a defendant gives notice pursuant to that particular statute that they intend to introduce evidence in the nature of expert opinions concerning his or her mental condition, the court shall order an examination of the defendant. Basically, the prosecution wants to send Letitia Stauch down to Pueblo, which is our state mental health hospital here, which it could take months to get in there, because I could tell you I've received correspondence and summaries of the wait to get in. They're completely understaffed. It's going to take forever if this is going to take place. But what is the significance of this? Basically, once again, she has to be put under evaluation for basically an NGRI. Even though the defense didn't say NGRI, they're kind of squeaking in, well, we may put some stuff in there that may go directly to the mental state of Letitia Stauch, and therefore, we're just putting you on notice, so it's out there, right? Well, what's also the significance. Why do you think the defense is probably concerned about their visits with experts or investigators being monitored somehow? Well, when you put your mental status, your mental state in play, so to speak, you can't use NGRI or diminished mental capacity when it's convenient for you, but then go back and participate with your defense counsel in all regards. So if the sheriff's monitoring them, perhaps not listening in, let's hope they're not listening in, I think that'd be wrong, but the sheriff is more than likely to say, hey, we have an obligation here to monitor, given Letitia Stout's history of the attempted escape, allegedly, as well. Well, that was the first alleged escape. And then the conspiracy to escape when she was actually in El Paso County, but I think she was in Kansas somewhere, Leavenworth, I believe, where it was a report that she allegedly tried to escape authorities at that point. So it becomes relevant. Does she sit around like, you know, somebody in One Who Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know, 99% of the time, but when her attorneys and her visitors show up, she's interacting normally, she's engaging with people, that kind of situation. So that's why words have meaning in the law, but more importantly, it explains why the defense is basically saying, hey, we don't want you to use what you saw in court against us. So if she's interacting and engaging with us, judge, you shouldn't allow it in. It's a breach of the attorney-client privilege. And I don't think the court's going to go for that. Just my humble opinion. We'll have to wait and see. Obviously, there's, you know, that's my opinion based upon what we've seen thus far, which is rather limited. We'll be curious to see what the prosecution's response to the motion will be so that we have a better idea of the issue and why the defense is so concerned about it. That's what I believe it is based upon my experience. All right, next on the docket, let's call the case of Brian Laundrie. Now, Brian Laundrie's body was found last month in the environmental park by investigators on the advice that Brian Laundrie's parents suggested that they search the same area again. Brian's remains were in such a state that a medical examiner could not easily determine exactly how he died. Well, law enforcement was able to confirm the remains belonged to Brian Laundrie based upon matching dental records, but they were not able to determine a cause of death until now, apparently. And Brian Laundrie's remains have been examined by an anthropologist, and according to the Laundrie family attorney, Brian Laundrie died as a result of a self-inflicted wound to the head involving a firearm. Both of Laundrie's parents have been informed of the cause of death, and the attorney says that both parents are still in mourning regarding the loss of their son, and they hope that these findings bring closure to both families. Now, there's also been a late-breaking report that apparently when Brian Laundrie went missing, his family reported that one of their firearms was missing. It hasn't been discovered as of yet. We'll see where that goes. If anywhere, I think it's pretty much over, and we'll just have to wait and see. All right, next on the docket, let's call the case of Ahmaud Arbery. That's right, jurors in the trial of the three men charged with the murder of Ahmaud Arbery. The jury deliberations continue. They began their deliberations about noon Tuesday after attorneys made their closing arguments. 12 jurors obviously will decide if Travis McMichael, his father, Gregory, and William Roddy Bryan are guilty of murder and other crimes in the death of the 25-year-old young man. Now, jurors repeatedly saw the cell phone video and still frames of the shooting as attorneys laid out their arguments about what happened in the crucial moments that are obscured from view. In the short clip taken by Brian, a white pickup truck blocks the view of the beginning of the struggle between Arbery and Travis McMichael. The men move off screen and a gunshot is heard. Arbery and Travis McMichael are then seen with their hands on a weapon that is angled upward towards Arbery. The struggle again goes out of view, and Gregory McMichaels is seen in the back of the truck. A second shot is heard, and the camera shifts back to the fight where Arbery is throwing punches. A third gunshot is heard, and Arbery falls to the ground. Now, obviously, we're watching this verdict. It's rather significant because of, and I hate to say it, you hope this isn't what comes out in a jury trial. You hope that facts and the law prevail, but there were lots of talk throughout this trial regarding race. The defense attorneys put their foot in their mouth several times by saying they didn't want any more black pastors in the courtroom. Huge mistake. Couldn't even believe they said that, but they said it. And it's a public courtroom and anybody can come and watch. And then in closing arguments, it's been suggested that there was some weaving of some racial undertones in the closing argument by the defense when they were highlighting that Mr. Arbery was not out for a jog given his attire, his shorts, his shoes with no socks, and stating that he had dirty toenails. I guess that's some sort of reference to an escaped slave or something to that effect. Once again, I think that's completely inappropriate, and I don't see what that has to do to try and argue that the elements of self-defense were met. I'm a little surprised the court actually gave the instruction regarding citizen's arrest. I don't think that it applies in this particular case because these gentlemen did not know that any crime had taken place. They did not see a crime taking place. However, the judge, out of an abundance of caution, probably threw that in. I've made that argument many times over the years where I say, hey, judge, guess what? Cases come back when I tender instructions and you don't give them. But they don't come back if the jury has had an opportunity to consider them. And if, you know, we lose and they've had an opportunity to reject it, guess what? There's no issue on appeal. So maybe that's what the court was thinking. There's a mere scintilla of evidence. That's all you have to do to get an instruction. It has to be a mere scintilla of evidence that they believe that a crime has taken place and they can argue it was a mistake of fact. All those types of things that they can argue in closing argument. Frankly, I don't think the closings were that particularly persuasive by either side. The prosecution, I thought, was the typical prosecutorial opening slash then closing statements. This is the law. These are the facts. Here we are. Find him guilty. And then they save kind of their thunder for the closing, the second closing after both the defense all the defense attorneys have made their case in closing argument on the government's rebuttal. It was a little more persuasive. That's just the way it works out. So we'll wait and see. And if the verdict comes in, we'll bring it to you live, we'll bring it to you live. Hopefully I can be here to watch it with you throughout the week. All right, let's call the case of Alex Murdoch on the docket. Well, the attorneys for Alex Murdoch have filed some pretty interesting motions just the other day, and they are seeking a gag order and sanctions against attorney Eric Bland, whose repeated calls for justice have been quoted in the media since Bland began representing the family of the Murdoch's deceased longtime housekeeper, Gloria Satterfield. In the very detailed motion, and I'm telling you, very detailed, we could do a live show for hours based upon the statements that were made by the attorney throughout the case that were made by Mr. Bland. And who knows, maybe we will do that. Now, the highly detailed motion from Alex Murdoch's attorneys, and obviously we all know that Alex Murdoch is now facing some 30 charges, and we could make a live show regarding the detailed motions and the statements that were made by the attorney. They go on for some 6 pages, somewhat cataloging Bland's colorful quotes. In a footnote, the attorneys clarify that Murdoch is not seeking a gag order against Bland's co-counsel, Ronald Richter, nor are they seeking to silence his co-defendant's counsel. So it's only as to Mr. Bland. Now, Mr. Bland, when asked about it, laughed at the extreme irony in the motion, accusing Murdoch's attorneys of using the media to benefit his client. And Bland said that he has no plan to stop speaking out against what he sees as a system that has allowed Murdoch to thrive while people like his client continue to suffer. And then on Monday evening, Mr. Bland marveled at the latest maneuver. He said, "I am a gnat on an elephant of the bad press Alex Murdoch has received." He said, "Show me some favorable press that's been written about Alex Murdoch by anybody. He's a wonderful guy. He's so benevolent. Nothing. Nobody is saying that." Bland has also referred to the attorney's frequent appearances on television and on newspapers. As you may recall, Alex Murdoch's attorneys went on Good Morning America to declare that Alex Murdoch had accepted that jail time was in his future and that he had done wrong and that he's entitled to his day in court. And there's a presumption of innocence, which I totally agree. And we give that to Mr. Murdoch. And as Mr. Bland stated, "Hey, I'm not the one that created the indictments. I didn't hand them down. The grand jury did. Everybody's writing about them. Obviously, Mr. Bland noted that, well, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, People Magazine. So shutting Eric Bland down isn't going to shut down the Alex Murdoch bad press machine. And I find this somewhat amusing. The statements that were made by Mr. Bland that are very well detailed in the actual motion, I didn't see anything in there that was so over the top that it was completely outrageous. Now, the motion cites the ethical standards for both the American Bar Association as well as the South Carolina Bar Association that you should not, as an attorney, in a case in which you are involved in, make statements that could affect the outcome of the case. However, here, Alex Murdoch has so many cases, I don't think that Mr. Bland is going to be reprimanded by the bar, as apparently Murdoch's attorneys believe that a ethics complaint has been filed or should be. So I didn't see anything that was particularly outrageous. Now, Alex Murdoch's attorneys believe that not only should a gag order be imposed, but that an ethics violation complaint has been referred to the South Carolina bar against Mr. Bland. I don't think it'll go anywhere, but if you ever had a grievance, that's the last thing you want to have to deal with is dealing with the Bar Association. I'm sure the judge will look at this and probably tell Mr. Bland, yeah, maybe you want to tone it down just a little bit, but there's nothing there that is completely out of line. Obviously, we'll wait and see what comes about in the case and whether the judge, in fact, grants that protection order. Next on the docket, former governor Andrew Cuomo. That's right, the former governor who resigned. Why? Because there was investigations going on. Well, the investigation into the former New York governor found overwhelming evidence that Cuomo engaged in multiple instances of sexual harassment as well as other types of misconduct. So Attorney General Letitia James released her own findings that Cuomo had indeed sexually harassed multiple current and former employees and created a toxic workplace at the governor's office in violation of both federal and state law. In addition to investigating the sexual misconduct allegations, the committee investigated the deal that Cuomo had for his October 2020 book about leading the New York through the coronavirus crisis. And Cuomo's reporting about COVID-19 deaths in nursing homes and his handling of the safety issues of the Governor Mario M. Cuomo Bridge. The committee took a close look at the two allegations of sexual misconduct against the governor. The first was brought by an unnamed state trooper, referred to as Trooper Number One. She accused Cuomo of touching her inappropriately on multiple occasions and making multiple inappropriate and offensive comments. The committee also looked at allegations from former executive assistant Brittany Comiso, who alleged a pattern of harassment ranging from flirtatious and sexually suggestive comments from Cuomo to groping. Now, though Comiso couldn't remember the exact date of the groping incident, the committee gathered corroborating evidence that the incident occurred on December 7th of 2020, and the committee concludes that Cuomo engaged in sexual harassment, adding that there are other similar incidents not included in the report. The committee also stated that the writing in regards to writing his book that it violated state guidelines requiring that no state property or personnel be used for activities associated with the book. Apparently, Cuomo utilized the time of multiple state employees as well as his own to further his personal gain during a global pandemic, a time in which the former governor touted the around-the-clock state response to the crisis. Apparently, Governor Cuomo made millions as a result, because don't we all believe that politicians should make millions of dollars while they are in office and even immediately thereafter? Of course we all do. How ridiculous could it be that a public servant not get rich while they're in office? Come on, ladies and gentlemen. Well, needless to say, we all know Mr. Cuomo has resigned. We'll give him the presumption of innocence because there's still some issues whether he's going to be charged with that unlawful sexual touching charge, as there were some defects the way it was presented. That matter's been set over. We'll see if the state of New York has enough guts to go forward with going after Mario Cuomo, who, well, let's face it, he thinks he can do no wrong, and, well, he's kind of smug at it in everything that he does. All right, let's take a quick recess. Please go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up for a background subscription service. You'll be happy you did. If there's anyone out there you were ever curious about, what was in their background, now is the time to do it. If you're going to get involved with somebody, now is the time to do it. When you go to crimetalksearch.com, you put in the name, literally millions of public records are searched, and a report is generated. And it's going to give you a report. If they have multiple social media accounts, you're going to find it. If they have multiple phone numbers, multiple email addresses, it's going to be found. And more importantly, you're going to get information regarding criminal history. Hopefully the person you're searching has none whatsoever. But if it's there, it's going to be found. You're going to get everything you'd want to know, whether you're going into business or whether you're going into a personal relationship. You're going to be able to find out the information you want to know. So go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up today. You'll be happy you did. All right, we're back on the docket. Let's talk about some smash and grabs. Let's call that case. So on Saturday night, there was the raid of the Nordstrom store in Walnut Creek, California, which is near San Francisco, and saw some 80 people jumping out of packed cars, flash mob style, swarming the store and escaping with merchandise. Now, just after midnight Sunday, criminals used a sledgehammer to smash storefronts at a Louis Vuitton at Saks and Saks Fifth Avenue in Beverly Hills. Now, patrol cars arrived to scare the thieves off before they could actually get inside. And again on Monday, another group attempted to break into Nordstrom's at the Grove Shopping Center in Los Angeles before leading police on a high-speed chase. Now, although retail theft is nothing new, a weekend in which high-end stores in famed shopping districts were hit by large organized theft rings has generated a little bit of attention. And let's face it, ladies and gentlemen, it's okay if everybody is getting robbed at the local convenience store. But when you start messing around with people's ability to shop in Beverly Hills, that is going to get someone's attention at the California legislature. I mean, let's face it, if you shoplift from a little mom and pop store, who's going to care about that? That's just a misdemeanor, right? But you start stealing real expensive stuff and people can't buy their bougie stuff, guess what? That's right. The law is going to change and the hammer will fall, even in California. Maybe not in California, but I think it'll happen in other places, but we'll have to wait and see. And finally, on our docket, the dumb criminal of the day. Crime Talks, dumb criminal of the day. A man told cops he caught his boyfriend, John Miller, engaged in inappropriate acts with their dog inside their home. The two had been dating for around 5 years when the victim confronted his beau about the alleged dog incident. That's when John Miller began punching the victim in the head and body. Now, the victim's elderly mother, who is also the owner of the home, witnessed Miller beating up her son and said he grabbed a knife and threatened to stab and kill him. After Miller was located by police, he claimed that his boyfriend had attacked him in the garage with a metal rod of some kind. Miller claimed the attack began after he caught his boyfriend looking at boys in their underwear on Instagram. Miller was arrested and booked into the Santa Rosa County Jail on aggravated assault, domestic battery, and criminal mischief charges. Thanks for watching. Subscribe if you haven't. Like the video. Leave me a comment. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk. And don't forget, we go live 6 p.m. Mountain today.